and I love the talk that the Stick to Wrestling podcast provides me. I want to thank the Gibb brothers for writing that song about their favorite wrestling podcast. And let me see. Yeah, give us 60 minutes. We'll give you a wicked good wrestling podcast. This is Stick to Wrestling, the hottest podcast on the planet. It's a lot like an NWA Ric Flair title defense from the 80s. It has a 60-minute time limit. It's usually 4 or 5 stars. And at some point, it's very likely our asses are going to be showing. Sean, it is show 52. We made it.
You're supposed to use convivial. That's my tip off when I'm supposed to start talking. So how am I supposed to know? Yeah. Okay. So, the Facebook page. Yes, it is. Actually, we have a whole 2 hours of Facebook fun today.
Yeah, we are going 2 hours today in honor, in celebration of our 52nd show. And I got to tell you, when I was first approached about this, my one concern, my biggest concern was, I mean, we're kind of late in the game. Like in 2018, there were so many podcasts out there. And I'm like, I don't know if like there's room for one more, but I'm definitely glad we did it.
Yeah, we have seemed to have found a little niche for ourselves, just, you know, kind of doing what we do and, you know, working off our topic. So, well, you know, who knew that in a wrestling podcast, just talking wrestling all the time would be a niche.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll tell you what, tell the folks all about our fine Facebook page, if you will, my convivial co-host.
Okay, I'm not going to use the companion word now because I've been, I guess it's become a thing. It works along with the show. It's a lot of the people who listen to the show comment on the show, other discussions that break off from what we talk about on the show. It's mostly, it's actually all wrestling. And it's, you know, we have some video clips up. There's some rare old films, usually the 70s is from me, or older, sometimes the 30s.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, definitely.
Lots of that.
Of course. Hey, get on Facebook, just search for Stick to Wrestling and ask to join the group. There are reasons you should join the group, like today, where for the second hour, we took questions that were non-wrestling questions. We're going to do something a little bit different before. And by the way, we have the best Facebook people out there. I mean, they're awesome. When you go to our Facebook page, it like demonstrates that Stick to Wrestling has the best audience out there. And I will repeat, we have the best audience out there. If you argue with that, I will fight you. But anyway, before we get going, I have to apologize. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about the Viceland shows, and I was like, wow. Why would someone fly Princess Victoria over an ocean? Can't they do better? And I got to see – I took a real look at her for the first time. She's a goddamn babe. She looks like Phoebe Cates. What's wrong with me? I think I got thrown off by the gimmick or the pigtails or something. I don't know how I get trusted with an Arcadian Vanguard podcast, to be honest with you. But anyway.
Wait, hold on. Speaking of the companion piece, if you will, the Facebook page. If you were a part of the Facebook page, you would know that John has been agonizing about this very topic now for 2 weeks about how his ill treatment of this former fine wrestler.
Yes, I've known who she was for like 35, 40 years. It took me this long to figure out that a girl was hot. Something is wrong. But anyway, like I said, this is a special 2 hour 2 hour edition of our fine group, and we went out and we hit a home run for our guest. Big time. He is a killer guest. He is a legend. He is the Booker man. He is Jeff Bowdrin. Jeff, thank you for taking the time to be on Stick to Wrestling today.
Hold on 1 second, John. 200, 300, any more? What? I'm looking at the Arcadian Vanguard podcast money that Brian Last just sent me. 500. That's the mid-season bonus. Okay, John, I'm sure you got that too. Hey, buddy, what's happening?
This is why we compare notes. Not much is happening, although everything is happening. But Jeff, tell us what is happening with your podcast, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. Tell our listeners all about it.
Well, if you haven't listened to Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, by God, why not? Because, I'll fight you, John McAdam. We're the hottest podcast going right now because we break kayfabe on not just sports, movies, television, pop culture, wrestling. This week, John, on our show, we broke kayfabe on parenting. That's the kind of high quality content you don't get on Stick to Wrestling. I don't mind telling you. Although we occasionally do a Q&A. I don't know if you guys have heard about that. So other than that, come check us out. Give us a look-see. I don't know. You guys curse, you say fuck and stuff like that, because we occasionally will drop the F-bomb, John.
Okay, I like that.
You've had a fine series of interviews, Jeff, with the Brooklyn Brawler recently.
No, we didn't, but thank you for trying. We did Barry Horowitz.
Horowitz was like a big deal as an amateur wrestler in Florida, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean,
he, like high school.
Yeah, he was, he had an amateur background that, quite frankly, I wasn't really familiar with. But no, we've been real lucky. We've had a couple interviews with Bob Roop, who's been in the news for a video from 30 stinking years ago, or even more than that. We've had, a Butch Reed on there, Stan Hansen. We've been very, very lucky with some of the guests that we've had recently. And we had Barry Horowitz came on for not one but two appearances, because we just kind of gelled with him so much. And, you know, one of the things we try to do is we don't just stick to wrestling. We talk about a little bit of everything, you know, food, movies, and all this kind of stuff. And we got him engaged in conversations that not only talk about wrestling, but other stuff also.
Cool. I bet he was a really interesting guy to talk about. Guys with careers like that usually have the best stories.
Sure. And they've been everywhere. And, you know, that's the kind of, somebody told me a long time ago that the best interviews that you get sometimes are not necessarily the guys that are the headliners, because, you know, a lot of those stories, let me give you an example. If you interview Ric Flair, Jesus Christ, how many times have you heard all the Ric Flair stories by now, right? But you get somebody like Barry Horowitz, who hasn't been out there being interviewed, and this is a guy that's, you know, was in the locker room, saw all the stories, heard all the stories, has all the dirt on people, and, you know, those are the guys that are kind of fun to unearth and to be able to get their stories. And, you know, as an example, on the episode we recently did with him, we were talking about Owen Hart, because the day we were recording was the anniversary of Owen Hart's death, and he had some a series of matches with Owen, talked about some ribs that Owen had played on the boys in the locker room, because Owen was famous for that. So it was a lot of fun, because Owen is a personal hero of mine in wrestling. So I always love hearing Owen Hart stories.
That's right. When Owen first came in as Blue Blazer, he went around the horn with Barry Horowitz.
Correct. And that's one of the things that we talked about. Yeah.
All right. Totally awesome. So anyway, we're going to do a wicked cool show where we took questions from our Facebook people, our listeners. Sean, what is the first question you'd like to submit for discussion?
The first is from Brandon. He asked, what tag team wrestler would have been a better singles wrestler, and in what promotion time period would he have most thrived?
Jeff, what do you think?
Well, let me see here. Obviously, you know, as a single, you got guys like Bobby Eaton, who are such a terrific single wrestler, or I'm sorry, a tag team wrestler. But would he really have succeeded in a singles, as a singles guy, unless he had a manager and worked as a heel? Because Bobby wasn't really strong on interviews, let's be quite honest. You know, one of the guys that when I did my Bowdre and the Booker series that I really kind of turned, I felt like I had a way of turning him into where he could have been a potential really big deal as a single, and that's Brad Armstrong. And I think if Brad was dying to be turned, because he had, you know, that little something that never quite brought him to the apex, if you will, as a babyface. He was so strong in the ring as a worker that he just needed that little something more to make him a real, you know, high level star. And I think if Brad had turned and, could have kind of captured that heel persona that he never had a chance to work with, or even was given a strong manager, I think Brad could have been an even bigger deal as a single wrestler.
I always loved your concept of Brad Watts. That was awesome. Sean, what are your thoughts?
Hawk in the late 80s, WWF as a heel. Maybe like 80s, you know, maybe not more mid, late 80s, something like that, 86, 87 in there. Give him a run against Hogan.
That was my pick, and I will go a step further than you. I think the Road Warriors really held that guy down. I think, picture this, and I know, like, I'm not going to do a million fantasy booking scenarios, but what if Road Warrior Hawk at the last Great American Bash, 86, wins the title from Ric Flair. You slowly get away from Road Warrior Hawk. You just call him Hawk. The other Road Warrior gets another Road Warrior, so you have that tag team, and you push Hawk as like the mega babyface. I mean, I think this could have been – he was different than Hogan in that he was a complete badass, but that might have been the guy they could have gone up against Hulk Hogan with. That's how highly I think of Hawk as having singles potential, but obviously it never happened.
All right, let's go on to the next question.
What would have been the sigh that was?
I was just supposed to have an argument with you about it. You agree? We never agree on anything. We're just like, all right, we agree. All right,
so you're disgusted.
On.
Okay,
it's ready for a fight, Jeff. What do you think is pushing Hawk as a number one guy?
Yep. Hated the idea. I don't think a lot of people felt that Animal was the stronger performer. Hawk was more of a high spot guy. People are people that know me know all too well my love of the Road Warriors. I'm saying that very sarcastically because, you know, I get that they were a big deal and that they were a main event attraction and stuff like that. I just, you know, we had one of our episodes very early on, we had a thing about the greatest tag teams of all time, because we would have people that would say, oh, the Road Warriors are the greatest friggin' tag team of all time. And I just don't get it. You know, they were, let me quantify here. They were a tremendous attraction, sold, put asses in the seats, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, you want to talk about the Midnight Express versus the Road Warriors. You tell me who had more matches that belonged in the top 100 of the decade. That's all I'll say. Oh.
Without question, it's the Midnights. The people who go for the Road Warriors, and if you ask them why, it's like they'll say, well, they held the WWF, NWA, and AWA tag team titles. Who else can say that? And it's like you're not – I'm not looking at it from that perspective, and neither are you.
Yeah. What's that got to do with whether or not they're a great tag team? The fact they had the belts meant they were a great attraction because they put the belts on them because they were bringing people in. My argument was they weren't a great tag team as far as, you know, working like guys like the Midnight Express, like the Rock and Roll Express, you know, guys like that you sit there and you think these guys are great workers in the ring, and they were able to do great spots. When Hawk came in for the hot tag, it was awesome because he kicked ass. And then guess what? 2 minutes later, he's completely shot and blown up. But that's what the attraction of the team was. I get that. And now I'll probably get lots of nasty emails. But anyway, go ahead.
I always thought that when it came to the Road Warriors, Hawk was kind of Lawrence Taylor and Animal was kind of Harvey Martin.
They had a great entrance. That was about it. Them and Sandman.
I would say you're going to use the LT comparison. Animal would be more Harry Carson then. I think if you're going to use the whole Giants, Harvey Martin is a different position, John. You're out of whack there. Go ahead.
Ellering was Phil Simms, but anyway.
Ellering was more Jeff Hostetler.
I would say I did struggle with this question because if a guy's in a tag team for a long time, there's usually a reason. I mean, there's usually a shortage somewhere in his game where that partner is needed, you know, to fill out a void.
I mean, the Road Warriors case, they just kind of, you know, threw them together because they needed a tag team in Georgia after Matt Bourne got busted. And I think Hawk, the Road Warriors themselves as a team kind of grew out of that role really, really quickly. I mean, they were a tag team, but they kind of transcended the rest of the tag teams. They were such big stars. And again, I agree with Jeff that like the Midnight Express were 100 times better. It's just, you know, who got the main events.
Yeah, but you're not going to put in Bobby Eaton or Dennis Condrey as much as I would like it into a main event against the, in a long-term, deal against the champ. I would love it. But...
No. I know. So, yeah, I know what you're saying.
All right. So let's go down to Memphis. Who would have been the best heel in the 80s to work a program with Lawler but was never booked in Memphis? Jeff, who do you think?
Roddy Piper. They actually started a program in Atlanta. But I think that's when Piper got one of his scrapes with Ole, and they ended up kind of abandoning the program. I remember mm-hmm. after even had started an article and put an article in one of his magazines about the possibility of a Lawler Piper feud, which would have been absolute, gold on the microphone. But as well as, you know, the matches, I'm sure would have been pretty compelling. But yeah, can you imagine Roddy Piper as a heel coming down to Memphis and playing off a Lawler and Lance Russell? That would have been friggin' gold.
That would have been my that would have been my first pick. The thing is, you have to make it, to me, you have to make it realistic. Like, you know, Roddy Piper is not leaving Crockett or the WWF to go to Memphis. Neither is Greg Valentine. Neither is Don Morocco. But
The question says nothing about realistic.
Yeah, this is fantasy booking. I know nothing about fantasy booking.
Oh, well, then my answer is Ric Flair. But you could have done with Roddy Piper.
But he was there.
But Ric Flair was there in 82.
Yeah, 1 week.
Rick made his appearance.
Doesn't matter.
Piper was never there.
That's all right. You're right. Ric Flair was there. But I'm saying you could, Roddy Piper is a possibility if in early 1980, if you could have talked him away from Portland and into Memphis, which doesn't seem like the hardest talking into in the world.
I'll give you another name that I don't think ever appeared in Memphis that would have been great, but he was a homesteader, is Buddy Rose. And you're talking 1980, 81. That would have been some good stuff in Memphis, too.
Rose, you know, my buddy who's been on the show, Brad Brightsman, absolutely hates Buddy Rose because of some message board stuff that went on. But Buddy Rose, he might have been the best bump taker, I mean, from that era. He was incredible.
Yeah, he was and his heel persona was a real like SOB, like you really wanted to hate the guy. And, you know, there is now stuff that's out there. You know, we have a guy that's on our message board. His name is Kevin Orcutt. I don't know if he's on your board or not, but he has this treasure trove of stuff from the late 70s and early 80s in Portland. And I know that because Kevin is constantly messaging me going, why don't you do this as your match of the week? And it's some Buddy Rose match. And, you know, I've watched some of it and his interviews, he was gold, man. It's just no wonder the promotion was thriving at that point, was because the whole promotion was Buddy Rose playing off of Roddy Piper and guys like that. And then, of course, they kind of slowly started going down as, you know, some of the guys that were in there left. But, I mean, for a time, there was a lot of friggin' talent in Portland, I can tell you that.
Oh, for sure. I mean, Jay Youngblood was there right around the same time, like right around his peak.
Snuka, Jesse Ventura, before they all hit it, you know, big and mainstream, they all cut their teeth in Portland and were really good. Adrian Adonis.
Yeah, and Rose was one of those guys. Like, you know, Ric Flair always seemed like an authentic kind of nature boy guy with his expensive suit and his limousines. And Buddy Rose, he had that Buddy Landell thing where it's absolutely, like he's trying to be that, but he's not that.
Yeah, he was the second-rate nature boy. That's what made Landell and Rose so appealing.
Exactly. Sean, any thoughts from you? I've got another one.
I actually like both of yours. One thing about the Piper bit in Georgia was when he came back to Memphis, I guess they were picking up the Georgia tapings because he had to give this – Jerry had to give this ridiculous promo about why he looked so mean as he was a babyface in Memphis, why he looked so mean in Georgia. And he's like, well, this Roddy Piper was a bad guy, and he's giving this whole explanation as to, you know, why he was a different guy in Georgia during this whole stretch. So –
In, what was it, 93, 94, when he was feuding with Bret Hart, he would get on Memphis TV every week and explain that, you know, no, it's the people in the WWF who are the real jerks, Vince McMahon and Bret Hart.
And I think Buddy Rose is a good one, though. He would sit there and do 2 out of 3 fall matches and then do interviews between the falls.
Yeah, with that was other weird people. They did that in Portland.
Yeah. What about – this is a random one, I thought. I like the idea of him there. Not that he's a great worker at all, but Nikita Koloff.
Okay, I can see that.
Just for like the whole over-the-top thing that Memphis does with their supervillains.
That would have been interesting. I mean, he started in Crockett, so I'm back to that realistic versus unrealistic thing.
Oh, yeah. No, that's not going to happen at all.
One guy I think you could have brought in there right before he came to JCP and started blooming was Arn Anderson, like in 84. I think he would have been a great fit against Jerry Lawler.
Yeah, that would work. I could take that.
Actually, Jerry Stubbs, too.
Yeah, you know, Stubbs was one of those guys. He got a really big push from Watts in 83, and as a heel, they turned him against Mr. Wrestling 2, and it was a brilliant angle, and it just didn't work. He didn't – whatever it is, I like Jerry Stubbs. He doesn't have that it, you know? That's what I think.
No, I like them in Southeastern, but okay. Going to next. Next question is about in regards to Mid-South's national expansion. Do you think that Watt should have made his move sooner when he had the TBS time slot in 1985? Jeff, what do you think?
Well, I understand the premise of the question. The problem is that he didn't have the time slot long enough. And also, part of the problem when he did finally start to expand is that that's when the oil crisis hit pretty much all of his territory. So no matter when he would have started, his territory would have been affected if he's going to keep that as his home base, you know, by the oil crunch. And, you know, unfortunately, it wasn't 1980 anymore. And, you know, there weren't oil derricks everywhere like there were in the early part of the decade. So I think financially that would have, you know, no matter when he did it, eventually he was going to run into that problem unless he, you know, expanded and moved his home base. And the guy's from Oklahoma. He's not going to want to move from Oklahoma.
True. I mean, one thing I looked at from that point, I mean, and, you know, hindsight being 2020 and everything, I think Watt should have done everything he could. Maybe he did do everything he could, I don't know, to maintain that spot and use that as a platform to go national, because had he been able to do that, and he would have had to do it pretty quickly, he would have been out of that region that was being hit so hard, and maybe he could have expanded to other regions, and most importantly, onto pay-per-view. He had a strong syndicated network by the time he was out of business, but I mean, not having national cable, I think, really hurt them. And I think if they could have gotten a national cable outlet, they would have. But it's just that not everyone wanted wrestling. It's just the reality of it.
There was certainly overexposure of wrestling at that point also. I tell you, the idea that no one has kind of brought up that I think, you know, again, you said hindsight being 2020. If you look back, if Jim Crockett had been an owner with more of a go for the throat attitude and a guy that didn't want to stand back and make everybody happy, but really wanted to kick ass in business, sort of like a Vince McMahon, not that I want to pat Vince on the back, but let's face it, Vince had that go for the throat mentality.
He did.
Here's what Jim Crockett should have done. When he bought the UWF, he should have fired Dusty as his booker and made Bill Watts his booker. Boom. John, tell me what you think of that.
I mean, well, would Watts have wanted the job?
No, I mean, and that's a fair question. But I mean, just in this scenario, if he buys out Watts, so Watts got the nice nest egg, okay, then, hey, Bill, I'm also going to bring you in and make you my booker. Now, of course, let's take a look at the other alternative. At that point, I'm sure there's going to be, first of all, you got to deal with the pissed off Dusty Rhodes, who might try to start up his own company. But then you're also going to have the people that are going to be like, oh, is Bill going to try to basically take this company from behind Crockett's back? Not that Bill has ever done that to another promoter, mind you. But, you know, I'm saying, you know, as opposed to what we got, which is, let's be honest, by the middle of 87, Crockett, the promotion was starting to spin its wheels. And by 88, you know, you had the Barry Windham turn and stuff like that, but there was a lot of just, you know, repetitious stuff. And it really started becoming a little bit boring. They had the occasional flashes of brilliance, you know, the Barry Windham turn, that kind of stuff. But I'm talking about, if you want to grab it by the throat before you start spinning those tires, I would have made Bill Watts the booker.
And you see, I think it would have been hard because Watts sold out, I think it was April 1987, and the NWA was still doing well, and Dusty was still doing well. That wouldn't be the case 6 months later, but at that exact moment, I mean, I couldn't see making that move. I really think that, like, right after Starrcade 87, I mean, I've heard the story before that Dusty and Crockett like had a sit down, and Crockett, you know, wasn't terribly happy about what was going on, and Dusty presented him with some ideas, an earlier Luger turn, the Midnight Rider, and Crockett let him ride it out, and by the time he got done trying to ride it out, it was over for him.
Yeah, you're right, and you know, it was just, I've said this on my show too, Dusty had a run as a booker that was absolutely incredible. He was doing some amazing stuff that was drawing money. It was aesthetically really good. You know, you had great angles, but eventually he started he started cutting himself thin, and, you know, he just ran out of ideas. It happens, you know, and if nothing
else, every booker has a shelf life.
Yeah. I mean, if nothing else, tell Dusty, look, you want to stay with the company? We want you to stay here with the company, but we're going to make Watts the booker for, you know, 6 months to a year, let you recharge your batteries. Then you come back, you've got a year's worth of ideas built up, and we'll put you back in. You know, I mean, I'm just throwing that out there as a way to kind of appease Dusty at the time the situation happened. And of course, you know, with the egos involved, maybe Dusty would have said, hey, go screw yourself. But I'm just saying he needed to have those batteries recharged, or he needed to have somebody that wasn't going to go, yes, Dusty, you're absolutely right. Oh, you're the man. You need to have someone say no every once in a while. That's a terrible idea. Don't do that. No, we don't need the Western States Heritage title. You know, we don't need stupid ideas like that. And nobody told him.
And you know what? You could have presented it to Dusty this way. Like, because, you know, let's face it, egos are part of this business. You know, look, Dusty, we're going to do what Jarrett and Lawler do. We'll just switch back and forth to you and Watts every 6 months. We'll keep it looking fresh. And Dusty and Watts were tight.
Yeah, and that would have been an idea that would have worked. You know, it's easy to sit there and do the fantasy aspect and say, boy, this would have been great if that would have happened. You know, appeasing those, let's be honest, Bill had his own gigantic ego, you know,
yes.
And so it would have been very hard for him to balance that act, just as a way I'm sure it's very hard for Jarrett to balance that act with Lawler and vice versa.
Oh, totally. Sean, any thoughts on this?
Let me put an add-on question onto this. Let me say this. You guys don't know anything. I go back to 1981 and I ask you both. I say one of these guys in 3 years is going to go national and take over the business, or make an attempt to take over the business. Which one? And who would you say? Who would you say, Jeff? 1981.
Like,
not knowing how it turned out.
Well, no. I'm saying, you give me a choice here or what? Or are you just saying
pick anyone, a guy? Any territory you want that was going to go national and take over in 1981.
Well, of course, the obvious answer is because Vince has the New York market. But also at the time, if you want to consider how strong he was, I'm sure the obvious answer might have been Vern, because he had such a base and, you know, he had 20 plus years of tradition. But, you know, because Vince Sr., let's be honest, at that point was getting old. Nobody thought that the son that was the broadcaster was going to take over the business and do what he did. So you're looking at Vern, who at that point kind of still had all his marbles about him, at least seemingly. He had a great world champion. He had this guy that had just come over that was, you know, looking like a mega baby face. You know, people always speculate what would have happened if Hogan had decided to take a piece of the pie from Vern. If Vern could have put his ego aside, given Hogan a taste of the promotion, a taste of the revenue from the T-shirt sales and all the merch sales, if he could have put that aside, would Hogan have stayed with him and then still been able to keep his New Japan contracts, you know, through Vern and stuff like that? It's all speculation, but I'd probably say Vern just because of Vince Sr.'s age at that point.
Who would you say?
I would say Georgia.
Yep. That's exactly what I was saying.
That's a fair opinion. Yeah.
Now, the thing is, and here's the thing, I'm not trying to be insulting, but if Ole's running it, it ain't going to work. I mean, he was just, even in 1981, he was kind of in the past and, you know, looking forward. But I think the best one would have been Georgia. I mean, we were, you know, they were on in like 82 saying, oh yeah, wherever you're watching this, we're going to be out there soon. And me and my friends were like, oh cool, we're going to get to see this. So the seeds were already being planted.
My point in bringing that question up is that fortune favors the bold. The reason Vince won is because Vince moved first and Vince had the plan ready to go. And not, as early as 1981, it could have been any one of a number of companies that would have made the move. But Vince made it first. He had the plan. That's why. And then, amazingly, everything breaks his way. As Jeff mentioned, the oil crisis wipes out WCCW and Mid-South.
Yeah. Another thing, too. I mean, Vince was running Los Angeles, I want to say as early as like fall 82 or maybe early 83. But if you know, I've made this point on this show before. If you're flying over all those states to get to Los Angeles, why aren't you promoting in all those states? I'm sure Vince asked himself that question.
And Vern was already running San Francisco. He had started doing the shows at the Cow Palace and out in Frisco.
Good point.
Every once in a while, I have him.
No, I mean that's an expansion move. I mean, you know, what's his name? Who was running San Francisco? I know Roy Shire. You know, that's like an expansion move on Vern's part. I don't think he asked Shire's permission.
And you know, getting back to what you were saying about Ole, you know, Ole, another guy that had tremendous, tremendous stuff in his background. But again, that shelf life of the Booker, Ole was running out of ideas, I really think. And that's, you know, plus he had the talent that was leaving because Barnett, that's a long story. You know, the pay on the talent wasn't good. And of course, now the travel, you know, that was the first really territory that you were doing more of a national schedule, because mm-hmm. now the guys were going up into Michigan and West Virginia and Ohio and all that. And, you know, so whether or not they could have found another Booker in TBS that could have had fresh ideas, you know, and you think about it, if they had brought Jarrett back to run Atlanta for like a 6 or 9 month period, and while they gave Lawler the book in Memphis just to freshen up the scene and bring some new faces in, that could have been interesting too as they started to expand.
Yeah, things were happening so quickly back then. The world was changing so fast in the early 80s with cable and everything.
Yeah, because he moved first, and that's why, you know, that's really worked. And another thing about Ole burning out is that he was booking two territories for a while there too.
Yeah,
he wasn't
that's
just booking
true.
Georgia, and he was booking Mid-Atlantic too.
That's absolutely right.
Okay, next one up. If Hogan doesn't get the role in Rocky III as Thunderlips, does he stay in WWF as a heel? Because there's no broad appeal from non-wrestling fans, is there even a rock and wrestling connection on MTV, WrestleMania? If somehow Vince keeps going with WrestleMania, does he face turn Hogan somehow? If not, who is the face?
I think Hogan's face turn was inevitable, basically. You know, I mean, they had to see that the giant guy, he was like, they're going to be their new Andre, I think.
Yeah, I don't think the Rocky III role mattered a bit. That was the guy. I think second Vince had this idea. That was my guy. And I remember there's been a bunch of shows about this, and no one could ever really think of another guy. Like, who would you even pick at that time aside of him, Jeff?
There really wasn't any. I mean, the Giants, you know, the muscle heads didn't really come into favor until the middle part of the decade. So, but at that point, you know, and you have to remember, you know, Vince Sr. was in love with Billy Graham. So was Vince Jr. Billy Graham had been so successful in the New York area in that market. And so now they had a guy that was bigger than Billy Graham, you know, as far as his physique and his size. And, you know, he just had that look and that presence, and he was the second coming of Billy Graham. I don't think that's an insult to say that to Hogan. I think Hogan would admit that.
No, I totally think that. I mean, they were extremely similar, especially when Hogan first got to the WWF in like late 1979. I mean, he was a superstar Billy Graham clone. But to answer that person's question, Hulk Hogan, he was in the WWF. He had the longest heel run in either the Bruno or the Backlund era. He showed up, like I said, November 79, and he was gone like April or May 1981. That is a long time for a heel run. It's literally more than twice what your standard heel got. And it was just time for him to go, and had he not gotten the Rocky III role, which I do think was a big deal as far as him being elevated and put in that spot that he eventually got in 1984. I heard a long time ago that had he not gotten that role, he would have gone to JCP. That would have been his next stop.
Actually, he was on one of the promotions for the first WrestleMania. Hogan was.
That's right. He was booked on the card as Wahoo's tag team partner, I think.
Starrcade 83, you mean? Okay, yeah, I saw that in the magazines, and it's been disputed whether or not that was actually going to happen, but yeah, he would have been on the undercard of Starrcade 83, according to the Aftermags.
As a side question about this with Hogan, how important was that time in the AWA as far as honing his face at? Because as you said, he really never was a face, and you work with Nick Bockwinkel enough times, and you're going to start learning some stuff.
He was a face in Memphis for at least a little while, but I know what you're saying. The bulk of his career was as a heel.
Yeah, I mean, he got to play off of Bobby Heenan and Nick Bockwinkel. I mean, they talk about going to class every night.
Yeah, exactly. Really. Exactly. How important was that to him in his development and coming to the WWF?
Vitally important. I mean, that is where the Hulk Hogan character of the mid-80s was formed. I think it was incredibly important. I think it would have been hard. Like, let's say move up the timetable. Let's say Hogan is still in the WWF and he turns babyface, and that's like his audition to be a babyface. Like, I am not crazy about that idea. Like the AWA part, you know, him going to the AWA first, way better as far as like his development goes.
Yeah, I just think that was because he was a different guy when he came back.
Totally. And you notice they hooked him the first time he's on TV. Who's he on TV with? The guy whose position he's about to take.
Yeah. Giving him the rub.
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't think Hogan was the guy either way. But I mean, you're right. It was probably a different road. But okay. Next up, we have starting in 83, any promotion. Who was the best worker despite not having the quote look physique? This is in reference to Andy Ruiz's upset win in the boxing fight the other night. Jeff, who do you think?
Let me see. You know, when you sent me that question, you know, the first guy I thought of course was Buddy, but at that point, Buddy had a really good physique. He hadn't started getting his gut yet. I'll tell you a guy, that was a really good worker that people don't talk about, tremendous on the microphone, that had the proverbial bad body. He did not have a national run. He was primarily in Tennessee and Memphis, Nashville, and that's Phil Hickerson. That was a guy with a bad body that was a tremendous performer. By 83, that was before he did the gimmick later in the decade where he was a Chinese guy. I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
That was later in the decade. But you know, like his, you know, I've mentioned it before. Bobby Eaton said the greatest tag team he ever saw was Dennis Condrey and Phil Hickerson, you know, and yeah. It was because they could talk and they could work and, you know, but and here's Phil, a guy with a classic bad body. And unfortunately, I got to be honest with you. One of the things that you don't see in pro wrestling anymore is guys with bad bodies. You know, you have Kevin Owens in the WWE and, you know, but really, I mean, what attempt have they made to make this guy a huge star? He's sort of done it without their help. And, you know, guys would have bad bodies, guys like Dusty Rhodes and people like that. They've been a staple of the industry for, you know, 40, 50 years. And Suddenly it's like there's an archetype. And if you don't look like this, you know, you don't have the muscles and God forbid the friggin' tats that every wrestler coming up seemingly has now, you know, you're just not somebody they think can get over. And I think that's a real waste of opportunity there.
I think it's important to note that we finally have had a P.Y. Chuhai reference here at Wrestling. Finally, 52 shows in, we get this in. Sean, your thoughts?
I agree with Phil. Phil was the man. It was him and Dennis Condrey. It was the bicentennial Kings or the Wrecking Crew, as Lance always used to call them. In the late 70s, they were just fantastic. He was one of the great bumpers. He also had a great team with Al Green, the Sherman Tanks, back in the earlier 70s. But he was a tremendous. I was thinking Adrian Adonis. In 1983, Adrian was as good a worker as there was. And the guy we also mentioned earlier, Buddy Rose, with the blowaway diet.
Yeah. I would actually say now that you've stole my thunder, Adrian probably even more so than Phil Hickerson, because Adrian was, you know, before he let himself go, he had a weird body type, bad body. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking adorable Adrian. I'm talking, you know, like with the pink tights and the bleached hair. I'm talking about the Adrian that was Jesse's partner, that was Dick Murdoch's partner. That guy could work his ass off.
Where do I start? I agree with Adrian Adonis. He's probably on the top of my list. I mean, like you said, he had a really weird body. And there was a point, probably, I mean, 82, 83, you could have made the argument that Adrian Adonis was the best in-ring performer in the world. And yeah, I'm aware of Ric Flair's existence. That's how good he was. Buddy Rose, when Buddy Rose got to the WWF, this was summer of 82, and maybe it's because it's a WWF thing, but everyone who saw him was like, oh my God, fat boy. Like, you know, I don't really agree that he had a good body in the early 80s, but I mean, he's certainly not as bad as, you know, what he ballooned into at one point. Back to Adonis, I mean, when Adrian got ridiculously heavy in like 70, 87, 88, when he was in the AWA, I was saying that he could have been like a Crusher Blackwell type. Like, just push him as a fat guy. He could still work. And by the way, I said Crusher Blackwell. He's another guy who was a good worker for someone that size. One guy we forgot, Harley Race.
Well, yep. Harley was, you know, at some point, when Harley, his beer gut just got ridiculous. It was one of these things where you're going, really, this guy's with the long mutton chops, the gray mutton chops and the huge gut, that's your world champion. And, you know, when you can would compare, I'm talking about your average person that looked at, on a newsstand that saw Harley race with a big beer gut and the gray sideburns. And then they looked and they saw, like, you know, Hulk Hogan or Bob Backlund. They'd go, what are you talking about? This old man. So, you know, but earlier in the decade before he got the beer gut, you know, you're absolutely right. Harley was a tremendous, and he was still a great talent with the beer gut. I just didn't think he looked like a world champion anymore.
Well, thank you for saying that, Jeff, because I always thought the same thing. I'm talking like, you know, when I was in seventh grade or sixth grade, and I see that Harley Race has won the NWA title. I was kind of like, you know, what? This guy didn't strike me as being at that level. And that's not a swipe at his wrestling ability or him personally as, you know, a guy who could kick everybody's ass, but just someone who just didn't. I never thought he looked the part.
I'll give you another one. Guys with a beer gut too that were Dick Murdoch.
Yeah.
You know, Dick Murdoch didn't have a great body, but you know, he could go for 60 minutes and, you know, he could have a great five-star match, or he could go out there and act a fool and completely stink the joint out. You never knew what you were going to get.
Dick's mentor.
Yeah. Killer Carl Cox.
Yeah. A quick story about Harley. I think Harley was in a match in St. Louis against Bruno. And it was an hour match. I guess afterwards, Harley's telling the story. Afterwards, Bruno was sucking air, and Harley decides to light up a cigarette in the locker room so Bruno can see him across the way. Just kind of seeing, like, this is how we roll in the NWA, you know. But anyway, yeah, I thought Harley just exuded that. I know he didn't look like it, but he just exuded that badass thing. Even when he was in with Hogan, I'm sitting there like, come on, Harley, just take care of this guy. He just had that thing about him. I can't even explain it.
Well, don't forget, he was the greatest wrestler on God's green earth. That was his promo that he kept repeating over and over again. Yep. It was a great line.
It was the one thing about the first Starrcade I hated was the fact that Harley's putting a bounty up on somebody. I was like, shut up. No, he's not. It's Harley. So, okay, I'm looking forward to this question because I really don't have a good answer here, but you guys will.
Don't be so sure of that.
No, I'm pretty sure of this one. What tape match footage is the crown jewel of your collection, Jeff?
Well, let me again on this fine program reiterate that most of my collection that I had now resides in Nashua, New Hampshire, because I sent a lot of it up to my friend Mr. McAdam. I will say that, let me see here. The first thing that came to mind when I saw this question was I had a tape. I'm gonna educate some of the people here that aren't into Japanese wrestling. I had a tape of the match where Akira Maeda threw the shoot kick on Riki Choshu, which was a huge monumental deal in Japan. Maybe not so much here in the United States for people that weren't into Japanese wrestling. But I had that match, which at the time was it was kind of a bootleg thing, and it was really in demand by people that were into tape trading.
I remember that, and it was kind of a holy grail. And I pardon my French here, but I remember when I first saw that. We have an expression up here in Nashville. It's called cheap shot motherfucker, and that's what I said about Ricky, not Riki Choshu. He's the one who took it. Maeda. I mean, it was a total cheap shot. Choshu was completely defenseless, and Maeda kind of got over with the newsletters for doing that. And it's just really, to this day, I'm kind of pissed off about it. It was such a cheap shot.
But think about, first of all, you're absolutely right, but think about what, like, that ball rolling down the proverbial hill started.
Yes.
He ended up starting rings and, you know, promotions like that and the work shoots that, you know, I tell you, people disagree. I really think if you look back and you see the history, as that ball started rolling downhill, that's where all of a sudden stuff that it ended up becoming like Pride and UFC, suddenly there was a market for that kind of stuff that hadn't necessarily been there before. And, you know, that was a shoot kick that changed professional wrestling and mixed martial arts, in my opinion.
Oh, it totally did. It totally did. It got the whole UWF thing going, and it changed. Like, you know, and you're right. It was kind of weird. UWF was doing, as you called it, these worked shoots.
Yeah, and they were. But they had, I remember, because I had interviewed Carl Gotch. Carl Gotch was not a fan of the kicks, But let's be honest, if, you know, Takata and Maeda, who are great, great wrestlers, went in there and just worked a tight, snug, submission-based match, it's really not going to be that great. But boy, when those guys went in there and started throwing stiff or even semi-stiff kicks, that's the stuff that popped their fans. And but Gotch hated that crap. And he told me, he says, oh, I wish they wouldn't kick. It makes me crazy. But that's part of the appeal of promotion.
I had someone come up to me in like 91, right before I started trying to promote. And they were like, why don't you just have the matches be shoots? You know, like, they didn't use the word shoots, but like have the guys go in there and really fight. That would be awesome. And I told them, think about the last real fight you saw. It wasn't that good, was it? And he kind of, oh yeah, the light kind of went on with him. But Sean, there has to be, I mean, you know, less so with for you than me and Jeff. There's got to be something that you just kind of said, aha, this exists and I have it. Because it happened for me.
Yes, I believe it was one of the 1981 Georgia DVDs that you sent me as opposed to throwing them away. You had a series of DVDs you were about to throw and toss out. You're like, oh, do you want these? I'm like, sure. And I found it in there. So yeah, it's that's why I wanted to get my answer just out of the way, because my answer really – I probably won either that or one of the early ECW tapes I also bought from you. So yeah, there's nothing extraordinary. You guys are much more extensive into this. So John, what was yours? This should be good.
Well, I'll tell you, I have two answers to this question. My first one, Jeff's going to hang up on us when I start telling this story. I want to say 95 or 96, I get Steve an update from Steve Friedlander, who's a really cool guy, and I've known him for a long time, and I haven't talked to him in like 10 years.
I used to get tapes from Steve also.
Okay. Yeah, of course you know Steve. And one day his update arrives. And he has three tapes that is now known as the Rocky Raymond footage. It's Bruno and Backlund title defenses from the 70s, like old 8mm footage. And I see this and I'm like, I'm going crazy. And I go to the phone. I'm like, Steve, if I send you a check right now, can you get this to me as quickly as possible? And he was a great guy. Oh, sure, Joe, no problem. And I remember watching those and just being like, you know, okay, it stinks, but it's my childhood. Another one was a friend of mine who got WWE 24/7 back when like no one got it, recorded, I want to say it was May 1976. The main event was Bruno and Tony Parisi against superstar Billy Graham and Ivan Koloff in Madison Square Garden. And you had all the guys from 76 when I first started watching. And I thank my friend for this. I'm like, I'm going to go home. I'm going to watch this. And it's going to be a bunch of guys standing still. But, you know, damn it, it's my childhood. And then my friend says, oh, I'll check this out for the first time. And he's looking at it. And he's like, John's right. It's a bunch of guys just standing around. Nothing's going on. And my last one, we talked about this on the show when it dropped maybe not even three months ago, probably more like 2 months, when they unearthed the first Bob Backlund versus Greg Valentine match from Madison Square Garden, January 1979. Like I couldn't wait to see it. I was afraid I was going to be disappointed, and I was not. I mean, by 1979 WWF standards, it was an outstanding match.
Well, I'll mention two more things that have kind of popped into my head, and this is not part of my collection, but the WWE, of course, finally putting out there the Tommy Rich, Buzz Sawyer, Last Battle of Atlanta match was a real big deal because nobody had that in the tape collecting biz back in the day. And, you know, John, I'll tell you another one that I thought of is that when we got wind that Cornette had found all those tapes in the Mid-Atlantic office and was converting them, and he sent those out, the old Raw footage, and it's out there everywhere now, but the Raw footage from the Mid-Atlantic shows in the late 70s.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that was amazing stuff. But what was also great, and I'm going to have to ask you if you still have this, because I would love to see these things if you still have them, the three videos he did for the Flair Steamboat, where he made a music video out of each match, the Chicago, New Orleans, and Nashville match. Do you still have those?
I don't. I remember them though. One was to one hit to the body.
Yeah, and then there was one to a. It was either a Phil Collins or Genesis song that was really really good. I think that was for the Nashville, and it was like watching something that was on MTV at the time. Of course, MTV no longer plays videos, but I digress. But you know, at the time, you watch it and you're like, you could easily throw this on MTV or Friday Night Videos. Remember Friday Night Videos?
I sure do.
And you know, it was because it was network production quality. Jimmy did a great job on doing those videos, and I wish he had done more of them because they were awesome. I would have bought the video just to get those three music videos. And if any of your listeners out there have them, I'm available on Breaking Kayfabe because I would love to get a copy of those videos. They're great stuff.
You know what? I have one more that I'm going to save until the end of this podcast because everyone's going to flip out.
You're kayfabing me, McAdam.
No, because I'm going to be telling you the truth in like 10. We've only got like 10 minutes left. Sean, what is our next question?
I was going to say, not a lot of time left. Okay, so this next question is about the Grand Wizard and how he had passed away and the rumors that he had overdosed. I'd never heard that he'd overdosed, but I guess there was rumors about that. What was your reaction, John, to when the Wizard died?
I mean, first of all, I thought nothing. Here's the thing. John Boucher, who's been on the show before as a guest, sent me something from the Boston Globe. So right there from like December or November 1983 when the Grand Wizard died. And it talked about how, Leigh Montville wrote the article and it said that the Grand Wizard died of an overdose and that no one was surprised. Somehow I never saw this article, despite the fact that I subscribed to the Boston Globe at that time. But my reaction was when he died was kind of – I was sad. I mean, obviously, he was a big part of my childhood. I had no idea that there was fair play. I mean, talk about me wasting things. I got – 20 years ago, someone sent me – a superstar Billy Graham was suing a steroid manufacturer, and the person who sent it to me worked for the law firm that was representing the steroid company, and he sent me a 250-page deposition that superstar Billy Graham had gone forward with, and that was the first time I learned that superstar Billy Graham was saying that the Grand Wizard died on drugs he had gotten from Dr. George Saharian. So I was like, either Graham totally is Graham says some strange things sometimes, let's be honest, but I'm wondering what Saharian could have given Grand Wizard that would have caused him to OD. I mean, downers or tranquilizers? I don't know. I don't know anything about drugs.
Jeff, what did you think? Were you familiar with the Wizard in Florida?
I'll be honest with you. I think I often wonder whether or not the Grand Wizard's death was more impactful behind the scenes because, as much as he was a presence in front of the camera, he also was very influential in the dressing room.
Yep.
As far as his relationship with Vince Sr., a guy that had, good Lord, how many years did he spend in Detroit with the Sheik as Abdullah Farouk? But a guy that had a lot of sway and a lot of pull in the dressing room. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a great impact in the dressing room that people didn't realize.
No, I've heard that over the years, too. When I got this question, I kind of started thinking about it. Like, I had no idea, until I got the Observer in like the, early 87, late 86, that like, what the wrestler's lifestyle was like. I thought they were – I was shocked when I learned that like these guys were major league party animals. I remember like right before the Wizard died, this was summer of 83, the St. Louis Cardinals traded Keith Hernandez to the Mets for like nothing. And immediately there was talk that like, oh, it's because Keith Hernandez has drug problems and baseball had a drug problem. And so, a little bit of, let's be honest, the early 80s, there was a drug scandal in baseball. And somehow I never thought that, oh, wow, could this be going on in pro wrestling too? That's what a dumb, naive kid I was.
I don't know if go ahead, Jeff.
I was just going to say, I don't know if the drug problem was as prevalent in wrestling, in the 70s. I think alcohol was definitely being used and abused, but I don't think drugs really started creeping into the business until maybe the early part of the 80s, I mean, I'm sure there were guys that were, smoking weed and stuff like that, but, the dreaded cocaine and all the other, you know, that was part of the whole WWE coast. You know, you're on LA one night and you're back in Boston the next night, then you're flying over to Denver. That sort of travel schedule is what started the whole uppers and downers thing that just affected so many of the guys within that promotion, because, you know, they'd be done. They'd have the natural high of being in the ring. And so they needed to bring themselves down. So they'd sit there and either start drinking or they take a downer. And then the next morning they wake up and, oh, I need to get myself up because I got to go to the airport. So they take an upper, and that whole cycle that started. And that's what, you know, quite frankly, killed so many of the guys of that generation.
Yeah, they would get on the plane and they take a downer to make sure they fell asleep. And you'd have guys collapsing at airports. It was a circus. Sean, I think we have one more question.
I do have one more, but I just want to give some background to the article that's being referenced. This isn't – I didn't see it either, but this is a major deal because in 1983, Lee Montville was a big deal. He would go on to write for Sports Illustrated, but he was probably their number one columnist at that point. So this isn't something you're getting on page 14 inside. So, yes, we have one more question. What if WCCW, World Class, and Mid-South got together and formed a new company in 1985-1986? Jeff?
WCCW was already on the way down by then, you know, because let's face it, the company was at that point built around the Freebirds and the Von Erichs. The Freebirds had kind of, you know, much like we referenced earlier in the show, a good booker has a shelf life. Well, a great heel act like the Freebirds were in Dallas, they had a shelf life. They started, you know, trying to work them with Devastation to become kind of semi baby faces in a way. But the whole key to the promotion, besides the Freebirds, of course, was the Von Erichs boys. And by that point, they had already lost David. Being very kind, Kerry was starting to show signs that there may be some problems. And, you know, I think after David's death, there was a change in Kevin, where Kevin wasn't quite as into the business as he appeared to be before, and not completely unexpected. Mike was never going to be able to carry the water, let's be honest with each other. And so I understand the question, and it's a decent question. I don't think it would have worked, because I think by that point, the Von Erichs were too far gone. And I don't know that they were ever going to let go of the control of the promotion and, you know, give it to, you know, somebody like Terry Gordy. If they made Terry Gordy the lead babyface of the promotion, I'm just, you know, throwing stuff against the wall to see if it sticks here. You know, if they had done that and tried to change the face of the promotion as a, you know, taking it away from the Von Erich boys, you know, how would the fans have reacted? You know, would they have accepted a new babyface that wasn't a Von Erich? How would Fritz have handled taking, you know, the lead babyface role away from one of his kids? I'm sure he wouldn't have been crazy about that idea if a booker had proposed it to him. But they needed to do something, because obviously with the boys and everything they were going through, it wasn't long going to be long lasting.
All right. Let me throw this in there. Let's say it's January 1st, 1985. Both promotions are still going strong, yet they both kind of know what, or they're at least going to see what the future is, and that's national expansion. Could we make ourselves stronger by merging the promotions, and now you have this like one kind of big super promotion? Well, let's say you're Watts. Do you really want to do that with Fritz? I mean, let's say you're Fritz. Do you really want to do that with Watts? And at the end of the day, please consider this. In 1986, Bill Watts had a better idea. How about instead of our promotions merging and I'm in charge of 50% of it, how about I hire everyone I can from you and then start running in your territory and I get to keep everything?
Well, and part of the problem is if they had merged, that would have meant that Kerry and Kevin would have now been under the thumb of Bill Watts, as opposed to Dad, who was never going to say no to him. Okay. And, you know, let's be honest, Bill Watts as a booker and an owner, he had the proverbial strong pimp hand, and he was not going to let those boys get away with no showing and showing up to the arenas, you know, dead stoned to the gills. And he wasn't going to put up with that shit, you know. And, you know, he had other guys in his promotion that did that, and he got rid of them, or he basically fined him a year's salary. I'm not going to mention any names there, but I think we all know who I'm talking about. But, you know, I don't think Kerry and Kevin could have existed in that environment, just because they were not going to be used to, you know, hey, Kerry, I need you to go out and lose to Ted DiBiase tonight. What? You know, Kevin, you're going to do an angle where you bleed because Jim Duggan beats the hell out of you, you know, or Steve Williams. This is something they're not used to. And I think they would have reacted very negatively. Let's put that kindly.
That is a major, major factor. And one other thing I just want to throw in real quick. There's probably someone sitting there right now saying, wait a minute, Kerry worked New Orleans. Hold on. Kevin worked Oklahoma City. There's a difference between coming in and dealing with Watts for one night and Watts dealing with the Von Erichs for one night, as opposed to having to deal with each other every single day. Sean, we're just about out of time. Do you have any quick thoughts on that subject?
Real simple. Watts walked in and gutted them. That shows you how much he wanted it. He picked exactly what he wanted. You know, he got Mantell. He got exactly what he wanted, walked away. So clearly he wasn't interested. I think by that point, if they were going to go national, they should, meaning world class, it should have been in 84. This is way too late. There's nothing here. The stuff that was appealing, he took.
No, except for the Von Erichs themselves. And, you know, like I said, you're kind of, I want to say, making a deal with the devil with the Von Erichs. But I mean, we know that they come with some baggage. What can I say?
Yeah, Jeff brings up a point here that it may be not. He was looking at this. Maybe it's not worth it.
You know what? I mean, he's not going to lure Kerry and Kevin away from Fritz. So he just did the next best thing. He took the Freebirds. But Jeff Bowdrin, thank you very much for being on the show. Thank you for taking the time.
Gentlemen, I appreciate it as always. I would encourage all you folks out there that haven't given us a listen to check us out. Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, available. BowdrinPod.com. Thank you, gentlemen.
Totally awesome. Thank you again. And part two of this special edition of Stick to Wrestling is coming up.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes the official portion of tonight's Stick to Wrestling. We have dimmed the house lights because the following hour has not been sanctioned by Arcadian Vanguard. And now, sticking to anything but wrestling, here again are your hosts, John McAdam and Sean Goodwin.
Okay, part two of our groundbreaking show celebrating the first year of the Stick to Wrestling podcast. And let me explain. This is like, to me, this is like the New Year's Eve show. It's like, this has been our year, and this is the very end of it, and we're going out and having fun, partying New Year's Eve. I'm going to share a quick anecdote about me. I used to be like the biggest New Year's Eve guy there was. I mean, I always wanted to do something big, especially when I was way younger. Starting when I was 13, I wanted to do something for New Year's Eve. And that lasted until like, oh man, my mid to late 40s. And I'm talking, you know, going to Montreal, whatever. And I'll tell you guys, the first time I tried to do something on New Year's Eve, I was 13 years old, and I had December 31st, 1978 circled on my calendar. My parents were going away, and they're like, oh, yeah, we're going to New York for New Year's. And I'm like picturing being in a car on New Year's Day, missing the Rose Bowl because of this foolishness. And I'm like, no. And they said, well, and this will tell you how things have changed over the years. They told me, well, you can stay home by yourself, 13 years old, because everyone did that. My parents were not like neglective or anything. Neglective is now a word. They're like, oh, okay, you know, you can stay home as long as you eat dinner with a family of a friend, you know, check in with them. I'm like, oh, sure. So I get my friends together. I had like a hardcore group of my eighth grade friends. They were four of us, me, this dude named Guy, Roger, and Mike. And
the Main Street Posse.
The original Four Horsemen. And I say to them, okay, here's the plan. Don't say anything, but we're going to have a party, a New Year's Eve party at my house. And it's going to be the four of us and every girl in the school.
Joining the Spirit Squad.
The original. So, yeah, the four of us and every girl in the school, and we're like, oh, maybe a couple of guys will find out about it, but that's still a good ratio. So me and Roger start calling girls, and I would say to them, hey, why don't you come over? We're having a New Year's party. You're invited. Come over. And I would get one of two answers. Answer one would be, Mom, can I go to Jim McKenna's New Year party? No. Answer number two, can I go to the party? Are his parents going to be home? Are your parents going to be home? No. Well, then I can't go. So I've called like 20 girls. I'm over 20. I go over to Roger's house. I'm like, how are you doing? He was doing the same thing. And I'm crazy enough to think that these parents in this small town are just going to let their 13-year-old girls go unchaperoned to a party where there are no parents. This is who you're listening to, people, every week on the Stick to Wrestling podcast.
Just hellions. I'm appalled.
I want you to be, because
so,
I mean, you chose this assignment. You know that, right?
I know. All those shenanigans going on. So we're doing a little something
Nothing
different here. This is again.
Go ahead.
I love the fact that you had to actually make sure you got that out there. You're all eight. This is what happens in New Hampshire. Okay, so
North Attleboro,
even worse. So we kind of put it out there again to the guys to ask non-wrestling questions. We are making exceptions to the rule for this 1 hour. This is why we have a two-hour broadcast. This is the lights-out version, if you will, the non-sanctioned Stick to Wrestling, where we discuss things that, you know, that you guys ask about things that aren't wrestling. So we start off with Joe Christie. We got a massive amount of questions on this. I mean,
yeah,
it was
let me say
44.
Something really quick. We did the standard Stick to Wrestling show. Now we're doing a little something extra. If this isn't your, you know, bag of cookies, I mean, just, you know, stop listening. It's okay. I won't be offended.
Exactly. And we're not getting into anything particularly ridiculous, like you'll say. But the first couple of questions, you'll kind of get an idea of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So first up, and if we don't get to your question, I apologize. But again, you guys, the response was crazy. Thank you. First up, Joe Christie, we're just going in order. What other subject beside wrestling would you do a podcast on, John?
A weekly podcast? I don't think there is any other subject I would do, like not even a general sports podcast for an hour. I have occasionally gone on and talked on a couple of different podcasts about like college football or whatever every year. For the past 3 years, Brian Lass has been nice enough to have me on the 605 opening day podcast where we talk about baseball. And by the way, if you haven't heard that one, it was 1 year. It was me, Brian, and Kevin Sullivan talking baseball, and it was really good. Kevin was excellent, but it's not something that I would just want to do once a week like I do the Stick to Wrestling. So the answer really is no.
Let me see. I would say there's a few things, but you're right. It's like an hour every week. Classic black and white old movies. Maybe, but it would have to be something like, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but it's a guy named Dan Carlin who does a podcast called Hardcore History, which is where he'll just do this multi-part thing about the fall of Rome. And it's I know it sounds off dorky, but it's awesome. And something like that, like some kind of like classic history something, because I'm just a massive history nerd. So if I could do that for like an hour a week.
You know, that's one of the things that's really cool about living in the times that we're living, like podcasts or whatever. It doesn't have to be something for everyone. It can be something like so insanely narrow that would never have been available 25, 30 years ago because it's such a narrow audience. But now you can cater to that incredibly narrow audience.
The beauty of that is you can do what you like. And, you know,
exactly.
Yeah, so you know, whatever fits your personality best, which means you're going to get better programming out of it. But yeah, I would say something involving some kind of history thing like that, like a Dan Carlin or a Mike Duncan or something like that, who are both great. To David Jordan, we're going to be doing these pretty quick because, again, there's a million of them. David Jordan, I'm a huge Pistons fan. Great. Which one of the bad boys got under the skin of Boston fans the most, John?
Let me see. The one Piston I liked was Adrian Dantley. You couldn't help but like – and Joe Dumars. You couldn't help but like those guys. Isaiah Thomas pissed me off to no end. I hated that guy. But at least I could respect the fact that he was an outstanding basketball player. I always saw how good Dennis Rodman was. You know, before he got really crazy and famous, I mean, the guy was a rebounding machine. He was an excellent defensive player, so you had to respect that. Top of the list, and we know who's left, is Bill Laimbeer. I mean, I hated that guy's guts. I was so happy when Robert Parrish just started punching him and punching him until he fell to the ground.
You got the most mild-mannered guy in the history of basketball, Robert Parrish, to start swinging at you. The reason they call him Chief is because there's never an expression. He's like the guy from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He never changed any expression at all. But you got him to flip out quick. Is he McFilthy or McNasty?
Which one was McNasty? Which was the other filthy McNasty guy?
Well, the original filthy McNasty was Mark Ruland in Washington, and the guy who came to the Pistons. Who went from Washington to the Pistons? Mahorn.
Okay, Mahorn was the other guy.
And then Mahorn brought the act, the McFilthy McNasty act, to Detroit, where he was joined by Lambeer. Anyway, quick Lambeer story. They have a this is back in the late 80s somewhere. And the old Boston newscaster, Bob Lobel, is doing a live shot from the old garden. And it's right before a playoff game. And they were talking about this pretty much topic. The guy who the Boston fans hate the most. So they get to Bill Lambeer. As he's talking about this, Kevin McHale's walking by, does not stop, does not look at the camera, but yells, "Because he's an asshole." And that makes it to the air. Okay, yeah, it's – you know what? If you want to say somebody else is just being – yeah, Isaiah was annoying, all these guys. Bill. It's Bill and everybody else.
Two quick things. McHale, I miss guys like McHale. I remember when he was a GM and he was talking about, you know, how it sucks nowadays that everyone gets along and everyone's, you know, has the same agent and there's just not that like really nasty personal stuff going on out there. And yeah, I do miss that a little bit, but let me embarrass myself. God, this was like 40 years ago. Boston had the number one pick in the NBA draft and the guy, what's his name? Who was the guy we traded? I've lost my mind here. Joe Barry Carroll. I was upset. I kind of trusted Red a little bit, but I'm like, man, we could have had Joe Barry Carroll, and now we've got Kevin McHale from Minnesota, who I wasn't enamored with, and Robert Parrish, who looked like an average NBA center. But man, we could have had Joe Barry Carroll. I really thought that 40 years ago.
Well, I mean, you weren't the only one. A lot of people – he made a lot of people look bad in your defense on that.
True. He was a major disappointment.
To Dennis Brown, what is your favorite sitcom of all time?
Ooh, my favorite sitcom of all time is probably Curb Your Enthusiasm. Taxi was really good, too. I generally was not a big sitcom guy, like right – after junior high school. I just didn't like the quality of them. I guess they're better now, but I would go Curb Your Enthusiasm. Seinfeld was really good too, obviously.
See, I'm going to say something that probably most of you have never heard of. Yes, Minister. It's a BBC show with Nigel Hawthorne from the late 70s and into the 80s. It was about it was a comedy about being prime minister or being a minister of the crown. It actually really was funny. I know it sounds weird, but it really was funny. As far as American, I would say The Honeymooners, All in the Family, and Frasier.
Those are all good ones. You know what was a really funny show? And I'm not even joking when I say this. Like at least once an episode, there would be something side-splitting said. The Sopranos.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I know it was a drama, but I mean, there was a lot of funny stuff in that show.
Sure, sure. I also, as a guilty pleasure, I like King of Queens. Sue me. They had a good chemistry together.
I don't think I've ever seen it.
Yeah, they have the three of them have got. I guess it was a big fight to get. He played the role in Seinfeld. Who was George's father in Seinfeld?
Oh, I remember him. He was a big-time comic in the 60s. I can't think of his name.
And this is when Lou would send me a message, and he did. Jerry Stiller.
There you go.
Thanks, Lou. And so, but Jerry Stiller kind of tied the whole operation together. But that also was a fun show. Okay.
Hey, let me throw a sitcoms thing in there because we may or may not get to this question. Because I saw your response, Sean, in my life, I think I've probably seen less than 60 seconds of Cheers.
Oh, my God. How is that possible?
I don't know.
If you, You were from Boston. It's on like four different channels at the same time.
Yeah, but I have a remote. Never thought it was. I mean, I thought Shelley Long was really cute. I just didn't think the show was funny.
I don't mean to disparage. It's a good show. The early days were better just because it was sharper writing. But it was. Here's a little fun fact. I don't think Sam was the original guy for that. It was supposed to be Fred Dreyer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was supposed to be Fred Dreyer playing a ex-football player. And he was a retired football player, and he had the bar. So, but it ended up working out.
Was Fred Dreyer too busy to be on NBC?
Well, no, because he had a couple deals going at the same time, because he ended up getting on that Hunter show, which is coming up right around that same time, too. So he ended up going that way because he did a couple guest spots on it on Cheers back in the day. Anyway, it's a good show. But if you're from Boston, you've seen – do you remember the last week, the one they had the last show?
I remember that week. I remember the week was like all about Cheers around this region, except for me. I was busy doing something else.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay. My God, get out. Jeez, it was just – they were everywhere. It was such a pain in the ass. But it was – in retrospect, it was one of those things where we had a question – it was on one of our boards where it was what's a really good song that's just bad because you're sick of it? That's Cheers for me. I have just and I can't get I gotta bring this up. I can't get past the part of on that area, that bar, the actual bar is on Beacon Street and I think it's Berkeley. Basically, a good big Dwight Evans baseball throw to the public garden. And every time Norm and Cliff go there, there's five parking spots wide open. Shut up. There has not been a parking spot open there since 1962. There is never a parking spot. Cars are getting towed. I mean, if you see like a 67 Firebird there, it probably was parked there as a new car. And they just left it there because, you know, why give it up?
Welcome to Boston.
That drives me nuts. But anyway, okay. So, yeah, but that was a question later on. What, from Brian Jones, what is your favorite concert and what is the one band that you have never seen but wish you had?
My favorite concert was Queen at the Boston Garden in 1982. The one band, I'll even go a step further for this guy. The one band I wish I could have seen, and by the time I was old enough to get to have gotten to see them, I mean, they were way past their prime, but I would have loved to see the Rolling Stones. When they did that farewell tour in 1981, I was desperate to go. Some of my friends, the closest show they had from us was Syracuse, which was like 8 hours away, and we were trying to figure out a way to go. If I had to pick one concert that I could have gone to, I think it was like June 1982 at Shea Stadium, the Clash opened for the Stones, which is like, yeah, kind of a dream show for me. But, you know, it's New York. You would have had to stay overnight. I could have stayed, you know, I had my friends stay somewhere for free, but we just couldn't get enough people to go to justify it. It would have been me and one other guy, and you just can't go to New York and go to a concert and do it that way. What do you think?
I guess. Let's see. Who do I have? I got in the late 90s, John Lee Hooker, the great blues man over at the old – it's not there anymore. It's down by Fenway Park, but the old House of Blues at Harvard Square, which had a very fine fried catfish sandwich. At that concert, at that show, they basically – to say a concert's weird because it was – it was kind of an attic. You'd go upstairs to this attic area. You could see like the attic, the split ahead of above you. And it was just a weird place, but he got out on stage, sat down, you know, in that completely laid back way that Hooker did it. And he just killed it. He just had that complete presence to him. He was awesome. I decided to have the one bourbon, one shot, one beer, which was one royal mistake. because I don't remember that. That's just not a mix that should go together. But he made it sound appealing. The guy I'd like to see, Jerry Lee Lewis in the early 50s.
Okay, wow, you get to do time. If I get to do time travel, I mean, definitely Elvis when he was first coming up. And yeah, Elvis over the Beatles, over the Stones.
Yeah, I would say Jerry Lee Lewis was supposedly a force of nature when he started out. And another one, it's not a concert, but I would have loved to see the old Marx Brothers on vaudeville. Supposedly they were insane. It was like what you saw on the TV and the movies is nothing compared what they were doing on like in the Winter Garden.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. And I say that I want to clarify. I'm an Elvis fan. I'm a way bigger Stones fan than an Elvis fan. But I mean, Elvis would have been such a happening getting to see him when he was first coming up.
Or another one. You know what I would have done is one of those old Alan Freed concerts. They used to have these little super concerts of the original DJ, Alan Freed, the guy who coined the phrase rock and roll.
Oh, yeah.
And he would put these super concerts together with the Big Bopper and, you know, that's Richie Valens and, you know, all these guys in just one super concert. I would maybe something like that from the early days.
You know
days.
Who got to see those? My mom.
Oh, no, those are supposed to be awesome.
She said that she bought programs from them and, you know, didn't take care of them and eventually threw them away and they'd be worth a fortune now.
Okay, next up, Joe Christie asked Lou Kippelman to do a dramatic reading of a Barry White song to close the show out. I got to tell you, Lou was so excited about this when he heard about this. Oh, he was just thrilled.
His voice went up.
Oh, yeah, a little bit. But no, so Lou will be happy to take care of that for you right here.
Thank you, Sean, and thank you, Joe, for the request. Rather than closing out our episode with it, I figure we'd put it in here just to shake things up a little bit. And I'm going to give you a Barry White composition that you may not be aware of. It's from 1968, and it goes a little something like this. Slipping in one by one. We'll be doing it, doing it, doing it. Doing the banana split, y'all. We'll be sliding it, peeling it, and scooping it. Dipping the banana split, y'all. Get up on your feet now and feel this new sensation. Here's a new dance that's in your town. It's sweeping across the nation. But first, we need a big, strong line. Then slide and peel into it. The banana split. It's a groovy, groovy dance. And now we're going to start to do it. Here we go. Yeah. Dip and scoop one time. Dip and scoop two times. Dip and scoop three times. Everyone should be sliding. Now peel all you boys and girls out there. You better not be jiving. Doing it, doing it, doing it. Doing the banana split, y'all. Sliding it, peeling it, scooping it. Dipping the banana split, y'all. And that's Doing the Banana Split, a composition by the maestro B.W. Barry White. Specifically written for the Hanna-Barbera Saturday morning cartoon, The Banana Splits. And now, back to you, Sean and John.
And another masterpiece by Sweet Lou. Okay, we will go to Steve Russum. As Boston sports fans, you guys have experienced a lot of winning recently.
Yeah, we have, haven't we?
It's habit forming. I have to think the first Red Star championship meant the most, but which of the others stand out? Also, has having so many championships changed you as a fan? Maybe you don't live and die with every game, or maybe it's not as sweet when you win. So let me ask you first, what was the one that stands out outside of the first Red Sox one? And to be fair, you have to take that one out, because that was a once in a lifetime. You had here for an experience that week. That Yankee week was just crazy.
It was, and when they finally won, it's one of those things where I was really glad I was living up here at that time, fall 2004, and just being part of all that. You know, the whole, they were up on the Cardinals 3-0, and you guys know me. I was the one saying, okay, we've got one more game to win. Stop talking about this. But people were, saying, I want you to win this for my dad, who was a lifetime Red Sox fan. He passed away and never got to see them or their grandmother or whatever. And it was really emotional around here. And they finally did it. They won game four and swept the St. Louis Cardinals. Behind that, I mean, I think it might be a little bit obvious, but when the Patriots beat the Los Angeles, it was then the St. Louis Rams in the Super Bowl in 2002. I mean, how we came into that game thinking, I think the Patriots were like 14-point underdogs. The Rams were the greatest show on turf. and New England went out and beat them, and it was a big surprise. And there was a 14-point turnover play. I think it was Lawyer Malloy who intercepted. It was Ty Law. Okay, thank you. Ty Law brings it back to the house, interception, touchdown. It gets called back. The Rams score like two plays later, and I'm just sitting there going, oh, my God, I've been to this town before.
Oh, I was thinking the one that was the touchdown. No, the one you're talking about was the holding penalty on Willie McGinnis when he held Marshall Faulk coming out by the goal line. Yeah, that was like at the three-yard line.
Okay, so yeah, you know where this is, saying the same thing. Okay, I know how this ends, and no, they won it. But another, if I may throw it in, really big one for me was not even a championship. It was the Patriots going to the Super Bowl in 1985. Yeah, they lost. Yeah, they got crushed, but it was such a big deal to me that they finally got over that hump and won an AFC championship. We'll go with that one too.
Well, the bigger hump in that season was just beating Miami in the Orange Bowl, which the Patriots at that point hadn't done in 20-some-odd years.
Yeah, they were like 10-point underdogs coming into that game.
Yeah, but they never – well, it had been a couple decades since they won in the Orange Bowl. There was this massive jinx. It was impossible. They weren't always blowouts. There was just these ridiculous screw ups and just one dumb thing after another. It was like they're never – so that was – yeah, that was a big, big deal. The Super Bowl was depressing. One quick thing about the Red Sox one, that was just the thing about leading up to that. I remember it was against St. Louis, game three, and they were up 3-0. And I called my dad up. I was like, he's finally going to see one. And I was like, what do you think? He was like, I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Well, you know what? Bill Simmons put it perfectly. After the Red Sox came back and beat the Yankees in 2004, and Bill Simmons says he was sitting there waiting for the guy on Fox to say, tune in tomorrow night for game 8 of the 2004, because you knew you were never going to reach that finish line. And that was just the mentality here.
No, and it's so it's you can almost not accept it. But do you remember the opening scene from Major League? That kind of like they would have those scenes in the middle where you have all these fans talking about the game from the movie Major League.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Boston was like for a week. It's all anybody talked about. Period. Yeah. It was it. It was the only conversation was had was about the Boston Red Sox. I've never seen anything like it. It was amazing. For me, I agree with you. It's the Patriots. With all that said, I still thought the Red Sox would win first. I mean, at least they were close. Yeah. The Patriots were a laughing stock for the vast majority of my childhood. I mean, just getting out of a season without a international incident was considered a moral victory at one point. It's honestly, look at 1990. You had more international incidents than you had wins.
Let me tell you a story about 1990. I needed a baseball cap or something. I don't remember what, but I went to Dick's Sporting Goods. No, it wasn't Dick's. It was the one that Johnny Most did commercials for, MVP. Mm-hmm. I walk in, I grab a Patriots cap, and I lay it out for the cashier, and she laughs. And she's like, we have not sold many of these lately. That season was just such a disaster.
Every season, the local TV station would hope they could get close enough to a sellout so they could buy the rest of the seats so they could put the TV. The Patriots were never on TV when they were at home when I was a kid. You would have to wait till they were on the road.
Listen to this. In 1990, they had the Giants playing up here. And what they did was they bought a block of radio ads in New York and said, hey, it's only 3-4 hours away. Come on up and see the Giants. The game sold out and it was all Giants fans.
While we're on this, I'm going to scoot ahead because we have a question here from Mr. Tamale about the accommodations at the old Schaefer-Sullivan Foxborough Stadium. So we might as well get that out of the way. But before we get to that, this is – the Patriots were – it was impossible. It was not – it was conceivable to see the Red Sox winning a championship. It was not conceivable to see the Patriots win a championship. They got thrown out of Alumni Stadium because their fans set a fire in the stands. That's how they ended up getting Schaefer Stadium, because they just ran out of stadiums. Everyone else threw them out. They used to be in fact, I've told this story before. I got these baseball tickets once from I'm from a reasonably blue collar family, and I got these tickets. They were behind home plate from a boss I had. I don't know why I did, but they were at Fenway Park, and my dad said, "Where are the seats?" I gave him the section. He goes, "You're a little left of the net." And I go, "How do you know? We never sat there." And he goes, "They're great baseball tickets, but they're terrible football tickets." That's where the seats were for the Patriots when they played there in the 60s. So, I mean, it was always kind of a slipshod operation. I mean, that's why another one here that was mentioned was the story about Matt Millen headbutting Pat Sullivan. Yeah. You were there. Who did all the fans side with on that here locally?
Matt Millen was the most popular person in Massachusetts for a week.
No one had a complaint with Matt Millen at all. Matt Millen could hit anybody else. It could have been anybody. It could have been Bucko Kilroy. It could have been like some management, anybody else but one of the Sullivans. And it's really not their fault. I mean, they weren't a wealthy, wealthy group, but everything was just so cheap and just so, you know, I mean, the whole thing with like Chuck Fairbanks, where everyone in the planet knows he's going to Colorado except Billy. And, you know, and he has to have this big dramatic bit where he runs into the locker room and fires. Oh, by the way, this is another one of these Orange Bowl gems where he goes into the locker room and fires Chuck Fairbanks 10 seconds before, like in the pregame. I mean, this was the stuff that was happening. So it just.
Fairbanks himself. Here's a guy who leaves an NFL team to go coach the Colorado Buffaloes.
Yeah, and if Billy Sullivan was your boss, you probably would have too. So again, in his defense, that you know, we kind of were for Sullivan because we knew at least that we're going to stay here. But aside of that, it was like sell it to someone local, please, and it finally ended up on its way to Robbie Kraft. But as far as that stadium goes, that stadium's awful. I have seen high school stadiums, not Texas, those fancy Texas high school. I mean Massachusetts high school stadiums that are nicer than that. Those seats were this. I had season tickets. My dad had them in throughout the 70s. I started going in the early 80s, and they had these seats. They were all no backing, just a metal seat with rims on them. Everyone had to buy these little chairs you hooked onto the bottom so they have a back. Somehow the hot chocolate was disgusting. I don't know how you screw up hot chocolate yet. I remember seeing one guy next to me with a flask. I'm sitting there with this horrible hot chocolate. He looked at me and kind of shrugged like, what are you going to do? You know, you're 10. I can't do this. They were often riots. The crowd was – the Monday night games were banned for 15 years.
Yep.
There's one road in, Route 1, which is usually
right off the highway. Think about that. It's not right off the highway.
Oh, no, you're on Route 1 for a while. So it's normally you're talking a 3 to 4 hour drive on a Monday night game. The best thing is what we used to do was my dad knew somebody who lived nearby. So my dad, you know, we would give him like a couple packs of, you know, a couple of cases of beer. And we just used his parking lot for the year. We'd walk the extra half mile in the snow to go see the game. I mean, that's what you had to do. It was really the parking facility was a joke. It was the concession area would flood. This was fun because the stadium was open to one end, and that one end was where all the wind came in. So the wind just turned into a tunnel. So whenever there was rain, it just poured into the concession area. There was no drainage. So you would have 2 feet of water. Little hot dogs just floating on top of the damn thing. If you hit too many of the bathrooms at the same time, flush at the same time, the whole system blew up. That happened once in the 70s on a test. They went in to test all the bathrooms. They flushed them all at the same time, and like five of them just blew right off the top of the thing. Okay, so this is the stadium. There's a racetrack right next door too, by the way. This is your home. Like I said, it's been known as three different things. Schaefer first after the beer. They were the first stadium to have a sponsor, I believe, or one of the first, which is so common now. Then it turned into Sullivan. That was so popular, they changed it to Foxborough. So what are your memories about that fine piece of garbage?
Well, I mean, when I used to live in North Attleboro, which was kind of, if you look at a map, it's like if you picture an X, and on the left side of the X is North Attleboro, and the right side of the X is Foxborough. That's how close they were, and we lived right off of Route 1, and everyone knew, don't go out on Sunday if the Patriots are playing, because that's how backed up Route 1 was. I did not go to very many Patriots games. I have always been that person when it comes to football, not when it comes to basketball, hockey, baseball. When it comes to football, I'm happier sitting at home and getting all of the games as opposed to going out, seeing one game, having to leave early, and then getting back late and missing everything else, despite the fact that football is the ultimate game that the TV coverage sucks. You remember that game a couple of years ago? They had the Madden view, and they won't bring it back. You could have that at the football stadium. You could see the whole field, everything that's going on, which you can on TV. But I generally didn't like going. The last time I went to a Patriots game was 30 years ago. It was 1989. Someone literally gave us tickets, so I'm like, all right, we'll go. And it was the middle or end of December. It was freezing cold. It was a 4 o'clock game. And about, maybe 10 feet in front of me, a guy just in his underwear gets into a fight with a guy in a gorilla suit. That's Foxborough for you right there. The entire one of the end zones was just one big fight at one point. I mean, everyone was fighting. And it wasn't just football. I went to King of the Ring there in 85, and there was 20,000 drunken idiots there. Like, I mean, me and my friends literally waited to get, and we were like 19, 20 years old. We weren't like a bunch of conservative old ladies. We're like, no, let's just hang out and wait for everyone else to leave, because I would say, seriously, 50% of the people driving in that parking lot were driving drunk. And I mean, like, falling over themselves drunk. So those are my happy Sullivan Schaefer Stadium moments.
Okay, a quick story. I think I've told this before, and I'm drawing a blank on the guy's name, unfortunately, again. But my dad was in the stadium for this one. This was in
– that's Mr. Goodwin.
Yes, this is Mr. Goodwin. Mr. Robert Goodwin was in the stadium and present for this occasion. I believe this was 69, somewhere in there. The Patriots had a little number they used to do where they would cut a player right before opening day.
Oh, yeah.
And then pick him up after the first 8 week, so they didn't have to pay the opening week bonus. Yeah, that's what you're dealing with. Okay, so they did this with this one. They did this with this one guy, and unfortunately, this guy found out from one of the TV guys that he got cut. He didn't even find him from the team. So I can't remember the guy's name, but he was a linebacker for the Patriots, got cut. This is like the second time they did this to the guy. He got all depressed and went on a bender. And it just basically, drank for 3 days straight. I read this in the AFL oral history book they had out. He drank, and my dad's told this story too. He drank for 3 days straight, and he gets talked into going over to see the Pats game because they have the first game. He's like, all right, I'll go. He's still completely smashed. Shows up in the opening hour in the pregame, one of the players gets injured. This guy goes down to get a couple of beers, and then he disappears. No one knows where he goes. What happened was the team found him, and they're like, oh, we have an injury. They threw a uniform on him.
Perfect.
And sent him out into the game. So this guy is absolutely loaded. He goes running down to cover a kickoff. He goes out wide in a desperate attempt to avoid everybody. The play unfortunately goes in his direction, and they run into each other. That's how the fans who were in his section found out that he is now in the game. Your New England Patriots. Okay, so that is what you were dealing with on a week in and week out basis. But as much as I just pissed on Schaefer Stadium, I will defend it in this way. Uh-oh. That when it was Foxborough, when they win, finally the Sullivans win the bankruptcy, but what happened? The whole deal was that Chuck Sullivan, who was the not quite as bright as Patrick, who got punched by Matt Millen, who got headbutted, decided to make a sweetheart deal with Don King in promoting the victory tour. Because,
Oh, that's right.
Why wouldn't you make a deal with Don King? Because, it's an honest man right there. So, of course, the Sullivans get fleeced. They're basically the only people not to make money off of this thing. And so they get totally fleeced, and the stadium goes up. At one point, the stadium goes up for bankruptcy. And guess who buys it? Robert Kraft. and that stadium still has a lock, has a lease with the team with a massive penalty clause on it. That if you leave, you have to pay this massive penalty to pay off the rest of the lease. And Kraft used that lease for years, keeping people from moving the team. And that's why Orthwein finally sold it to him. So there is one positive thing about Schaefer Stadium.
I had completely forgotten about the victory tour. But yeah, I mean, there, in a way, you look back and you're surprised. I am surprised that the New England Patriots never became the St. Louis Stallions, and that there's some other new team here, you know, probably in actual Boston, that, you know, back in the 90s, we got a new team, the Boston Whatevers. I think it worked out well the other way, though.
Yeah, but the fans who are old enough, and if you want to know a real Patriots fan, ask them who Tony Eason is, or ask them who Champagne Tony is. If they can answer that question, then fine. Okay, you can discuss it. Because those guys remember the old days, Champagne as opposed to what they became. Next question from Adam. Adam Lewis, we have a couple about our Boston, shared Boston heritage. Did either of you go to the old Ratskeller or to the Channel in Boston? Now, before people who are not familiar with Boston, the Rat, or as we call it, the Ratskeller was an old club that did a lot of punk and like the kind of metal stuff in Kenmore Square. Back when Kenmore Square was a little more Times Square 70-ish, you know. So now it's a little more cleaned up and nice and pretty, but it really wasn't back then. The Channel is another club that did mostly kind of Dead Kennedy. I mean, I know the Dead Kennedys did play there in Four Point Channel over in South Boston, kind of a rough neighborhood, but kind of two divey clubs that have a bit of a legendary reputation in Boston. What are your memories, John?
Here are my memories. I actually shared this on the board. I have not ever been to either club, and here's my tale of woe, if you will. Jeff had mentioned it. When I was a teenager, I mean, I loved the local Boston music scene, absolutely loved it. I mean, I remember the Thrills came to Manchester, and I was just so excited to see them. And the way it worked, these bands would play smaller clubs in Boston. You had to be 20 or 21 to get in. And by the time I turned 21, the Boston music scene had kind of died. And you know what? I just grew up and I didn't care that much anymore. Like I thought growing up, I would practically when I was in my teens, I'm like, wow, when I'm 21, I'm practically going to live at the Channel or the Metro or whatever. And none of that happened. And it's OK.
Yeah, I mean, it's they were. I think the reputation is more than the actual club. I have been in the Rat a couple times just because when I went to BU, my dorm was in Kenmore Square. Actually, if you see where the I love when I hear announcers talk about the Citgo sign going, well, that ball nearly hit the Citgo. The Citgo sign's a mile away. That home run ball did not nearly hit the Citgo sign. It probably hit the sign over the casket flagon. But nonetheless, I lived in the building right next to the building where the Citgo sign was. So we were basically right across the street from, because my roommate found out that Babe Ruth stayed there, which he did, but we couldn't find his room. We found it, but we couldn't get it. So I have been in there a couple of times. It looks like every like dark divey bar you've ever seen. They were one of those clubs in the thriving Boston scene. They were much bigger before our time in the 70s, especially the Channel. The Channel was closed when I was 16, so I never got in there.
All right. You know, I've always wondered about this. I mean, this is an off-topic show, so I can go off-topic on the question. They, right around 84, 85, they raised the drinking age. Well, they raised it from 19 to 20, I want to say in like 1980. And then they raised it, no, in 70, it took, I believe it started January 1st, 1980. So the drinking age bounces from 19 to 20. And then in 84 or 85, it went from 20 to 21. And I really wonder, like, how much that impacted the local Boston music scene. Because now it used to be that the kids that were sophomores – and oh, by the way, for those unaware, Boston is a huge college town. So when they raised the age, you lost all the sophomores. Then when you raised it again, you lost all the juniors. So I've always had a theory that had something to do with it.
Yeah, to back up your point, BC, BU, Harvard, Northeastern, and MIT T are all within like 6 or 7 miles of each other.
Yeah, and there's a ton of smaller schools too.
Yep. So yeah, it is
UMass,
a big deal.
Boston.
Yeah. Oh. And another big deal at the time was BCN was running a lot of live shows. So that was kind of how they got that rep.
Exactly. WBCN was the musical and cultural, center of Boston when I was growing up. And as time went on, WBCN, they got bought out by a New York syndicate, and they really started to lose their way. And you're right, but WBCN, really supported the local music scene. They put local acts on the radio, and it was the number one radio, station in the area. And when BCN started to fade, that definitely hurt.
One of their first disc jockeys was, I'm drawing a blank on his name. Who was the lead singer?
Charles Lacudera.
Well, yeah, he did the Big Mattress for years. He was the morning show. He had a party for when the garden closed down. He did his show there, and he opened up the garden to go shoot around. And I was in college at the time. I was like, fantastic. Me and my roommate went down. Who's the lead singer, Jay Giles? Peter Wolf. Peter Wolf was one of their early DJs.
That's right. And these guys were like part of my life, like Charles Lacudera, Mark yep. Parento, Ken yep. Shelton. I love those guys.
Yep, absolutely. So, I think BCN was actually the first station to bring in the police.
I know
one of the first stations in America to start playing the police.
I know that I first heard the police on WBCN, and Christmas 1978, I spent some of my Christmas money buying their first 8-track. And by the time it was not very long, every kid in my junior high practically had borrowed that 8-track tape from me.
So, okay.
BCN Impact, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, one more from Adam. Any memories watching the old V66 channel that was on Boston in the mid-80s? John? The V66 was the VHS version for Boston, their attempt at doing MTV. One of the early people running it was Arnie Ginsberg, who was a legendary Boston DJ.
Okay. I remember it came on in 1985, and it's just so mind-blowing. It's this UHF channel. No, it's this it's the lowest rung of UHF channel you can imagine, and they're trying to be MTV. And there was some cool stuff on there. Like they played some local music. They played like the Sex Execs. They played the Del Fuegos. So that's a big thumbs up. They actually played World Class Championship Wrestling. It was 85, and they were playing like episodes from 82 and 83. And we talked about this on one of our earlier shows. I guarantee you World Class had no idea these guys were playing their tapes from 82 and 83. And you could kind of tell the quality was off a little bit.
Okay, my answer is yes and no. Yes, I remember of it. No, I really didn't watch it because fortune, as I was saying in the first hour, fortune goes to the bold, and they come up with this idea 4 years after MTV.
Uh-huh.
And most of Eastern Massachusetts at that time, in the early days of cable, it was broken up by community, so it wasn't just like, oh, let's just go buy cable. You had to wait till cable got to your town or your area.
Yes.
And then so you could have your neighbors or someone in the next town, and they would have cable and you wouldn't, or vice versa. So basically, so these guys come up with this idea. They don't wait till before everyone has MTV. They wait till everybody has MTV, and then they put this on. So
yeah,
it was – go ahead.
They wouldn't have had the template had it not been for MTV. Like, I totally know what you were saying, but why would anyone watch V66 when you had access to MTV? But then again, I would do it sometimes. So what am I talking about?
Yeah, we all have guilty pleasures. So, okay, say they put it up in 82. MTV was around in 82, and you had nowhere near the cable access in Massachusetts that you would in 85.
No. I mean, my little cable story is, I mean, we moved from North Attleboro, Massachusetts to Nashua, August 1979. And like no one in North Attleboro even knew what cable was. But we got here and the first thing we did, hey, let's get cable. And so this is August 79, February 1980, it arrived. There was so much back order on people wanting to get cable TV that we had to wait 6 months. Can you imagine that today?
84. I had to wait to 84 till we got it in our town.
Or, well, you were in Brockton, right?
I was in, at that point, I was in Stoughton, which is right outside of Brockton.
Okay. Town over. All right. Yeah.
So
there was a huge demand for that and they couldn't meet it.
Yeah. So, but you did have a window there for about 2 years where you could have done the V66 and it would have worked. But they waited 4 years till everyone had MTV and then it's doomed to failure at that point.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
piling on to what you're saying, it took a while. I mean, MTV, like, you know, just because you had cable didn't mean you got MTV, and it just wasn't on offered by every cable system. But by 85, you know, chances are everyone's got it by then.
Yeah. So it's, again, good idea, but 2 years too late at least.
At least.
Go to Steve. Yeah. Steve Russum, who is on and he apologizes for using the Mount Rushmore reference, but who is on the Boston Sports Mount Rushmore? And are we including coaches here?
I don't. It's your Mount Rushmore. So you go ahead and put Belichick in red on it.
I mean, because if you're saying all around, then Belichick and red have to be on it. But if I'm just talking players, I'm looking at Brady, Russell, Williams, and Poppy. And here's a weird one. Next guy who comes up, guess who's getting taken off that list?
Next guy? Let me think. Bird,
guess who's
probably.
Four? No. I don't even have Bird there. Brady, Russell, Williams, and Poppy. And Williams is four.
Okay. So we're saying that you're saying that you have Poppy high on your list. David Ortiz.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. He was my number five. I mean, mine are the obvious ones. You got to have Tom Brady. You have to have Bill Russell. You have to have Larry Bird. You have to have Ted Williams. Poppy was my number five. And well, give me your reasoning for why Poppy is your number three.
86 years, no championships. Poppy comes. Three. And he was – and during that series with the Yankees, he was the biggest thing in the world. I mean, he was – you could have had him – you could have elected him king of Boston, and he would have won by a landslide. I mean, he was – Williams never won one. And don't tell me he didn't have the team because he did. Okay, they had several seasons in the late 40s where they had plenty of chances after the war, and they could not win.
I mean, I agree with you. I mean, that's the thing about the Red Sox. They're a team that historically has had chance after chance. And the problem was very often that the New York Yankees were in the way. And that's just, and you, another problem was back in Williams' day, they didn't have divisions. You had eight teams in the American League and you had to finish first out of those eight teams. That's just really hard.
They were up two or three to go, and they choked it away.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's
that too.
They have the old. I can't remember what year it was. I think it was. I think it was 2003. Yogi Berra was in the dugout, and I think it was Game 7. One of the players was worried because the Red Sox had the lead at that point, and Yogi said, "Don't worry about it. It's the Red Sox. They'll blow it." Okay, so they had their chances and they had the talent. Those teams in the late 40s were very good baseball teams. There was no reason they couldn't. Another theory was the fact that they overpaid the players. The Yankees had to earn the World Series check.
Good point. I mean, that this is back in the day when getting that World Series check was a really big deal because the players were compensated quite poorly. But so you're saying that Ortiz is on there because his teams won championships.
His teams won multiple championships on a team that never won. You know, at least when Larry won, there was a few years off there, but there was a culture of winning. in the Celtic organization that was longstanding, and the guys who were the architects were still there. There was nothing when, you know, when Bobby showed up. It was just a long, you know, I bring him up as the main guy, but he was like the feature point from that Yankee Stadium, you know, from the Yankee series. He was kind of the focal point of that team because of he was just so enormous. They don't win that series without him, clearly. I think we are too close to him right now. And years from now, people will look back and be like, yeah, he's a real big deal.
I agree with you. I mean, where do I start? Bill Belichick, I'm sure you're familiar with him. He has a saying. He's like, you know, winning is a habit and so is losing. And I think back in the day, even in the late 70s, early 80s, the Red Sox just had that losing is a habit thing going on with them. But back to David Ortiz.
In the late 70s and early 80s, they had that going back to the 40s.
Oh, no, I'm saying it was still there, though.
Yeah.
I mean, you could just feel it. It was like, you know, Billy Martin's big bad New York Yankees were coming to kick our asses. And it's like, oh, okay, ass kicking coming.
Yep.
But when Minnesota non-tender David Ortiz and the Red Sox picked him up, I feel like I was probably the most excited person out there. And I mean that. And I'll say this about someone else too. You won't believe this. Because I thought he would be a very valuable piece in the puzzle. He could play first, but not very well. But at the same time, the guy murdered right-handed hitters. So, okay, just find a right-handed a guy who can play first, bench Ortiz against lefties. You're going to have 450 at-bats. And I was saying this guy will hit 25, 30 homers and have a respectable average. I was all over him. And turns out I was even more right than I thought I would be.
He had it.
Yeah. I've missed on players before, but I did not miss that one. I mean, sorry, Twins fan, but our treasure was your trash. You know who I think I've already shared this one with you, but not with Sick to Wrestling. I was the only one excited when the Patriots selected a Michigan quarterback named Tom Brady. And I was saying, and I quote, I think he's going to be a really good backup in this league, and you need those. This is when he went in the fifth round and we still had Drew Bledsoe. And if someone's like, oh, you were wrong, you thought he was just going to be a good backup. Look, there's a reason he went in the fifth round.
Went in the sixth round, pick 199.
Even better.
Bill was, they have quotes from Bill in the war room at the time going, I can't believe he's there. I mean, the thing was that you look at him now and the difference with Tom back then was he was very, very skinny.
Yeah, and he didn't have huge arm strength when he was at Michigan. But here's the thing, and this goes back to, you know, Belichick saying winning is a habit. I mean, he won a lot of games at Michigan. People act like Brady was this unknown dude. You know, no, he's the guy who Michigan went 10-2 and won the Orange Bowl against Alabama. You know, if you watch college football, you knew who he was. But I you know, no one saw him turning out to be what he turned out to be. And if Belichick was saying that, I can't believe he's still around the sixth round. Why didn't you pick him in the fifth if you think he's that good, you know?
Yeah, that's the next question no one ever seems to answer at that point. But, I mean, yeah. Because, again, he didn't really need – because he thought Drew was going to be there at that point, you know. So, I mean, he was only looked at as a backup. So they weren't looking for a replacement. I'm going to jump around. Oh, here's one
Let me throw something in on that really quick. And I saw this with my own eyes. If someone told me this, I wouldn't have if this story was just out there, I wouldn't believe it. But I saw it with my own eyes. Drew Bledsoe got hurt like the second game of the 2001 season against the Jets. He got a ruptured spleen, which is serious. Yep. And I was saying, you know, oh, my God, we stink and we're not even going to get the first pick in the draft because the Texans were going to get that. Well, and so Tom Brady was inserted in as the starter. Before the game where Bledsoe got hurt, I saw this with my own eyes, kids, on Joel Buschbaum's old website, football.com, I don't remember. I saw it with my own eyes. Buschbaum reported that Belichick was considering benching Bledsoe for Brady.
I don't know how serious it was at this point, but Bill was not happy with the style, and it was a style of play. the type of offense that Bill wanted to run, Drew couldn't run. Drew was an old West Coast. When I say West Coast, I mean like the old Air Coryell offense. That was the type of offense he should be running, and they were. He had his best days with Ernie Zampezi, who ran that type of offense. Bill didn't want to do that. He wanted to stretch the field horizontally. Drew couldn't, you know, and you could see the contrast. Drew was just really struggling.
No, definitely. And but yeah, I mean, that was out there. It was I think it was Pro Football Weekly that Buschbaum had. I checked the website and I was like, you've got to be kidding me. This is Drew Bledsoe we're talking about. But anyway.
No. Here's a fun one. Favorite movie set in Boston. What do you think?
The Town.
I didn't even have to think. Well, OK, first, why? I did not have to think about this one. But let me. Why do you think The Town?
I mean, I think it really showed off the city as a unique place with all of those, like, you know, one-way streets and these streets that are mazes that were built in the 1700s. There's no grid in Boston, kids. And but I thought on top of that, it was a really good movie. And then you're sitting there going, oh, my God, these guys are robbing Fenway Park.
The Friends of Eddie Coyle. I have to think about it. That is the most Boston. If you want to know what it's like in Boston, you know, less so now, certainly back then, the Friends of Eddie Coyle nailed it. The book even more so. The movie's great. The book's even better. It was written by a guy named George Higgins, who was a former prosecutor. And the guy in Friends of Eddie Coyle who – the guy that Peter Boyle played. They always asked Higgins whether or not this was the – was the Whitey was the inspiration, and Higgins kept having saying Whitey wasn't Whitey yet when I wrote this. So, but yeah, this was been like 70, so it really captured the dialogue, that kind of the vagary that people talk, you know, the kind of language they use, and it's just it just nailed it completely. When I see that, but most movies I see in Boston, I say no, the accent's wrong. The worst was I heard Kevin Costner try to do Kenny O's. The Jack Kennedy's old assistant's accent in I think it was 13 Days. Oh, shut up. It was awful. He made the movie. But that movie captured the whole thing for me.
All right. Let me throw this in really quick, too. I mean, I basically grew up in Nashua, New Hampshire, and Nashua is – it's part of Metro Boston. It really is. A lot of people who live here work there. It's always been that way. Somewhere – I mean, it's not even a joke. Somewhere a couple of towns north of Nashua, like Merrimack, there's like a line there. It's an invisible line that like separates Metro Boston from New Hampshire. But, you know, like I said, so I want you guys to think that, oh, wow, this guy's sitting – it's like living in East Rutherford, New Jersey. Like, you know, you're kind of living in New York. You're okay.
Yeah, you know the people who think that Nashua is part of Metro Boston? People who live in Nashua. Okay, well, we have
time and for everyone that I – everyone that I just communicated that to. I've enlightened the world. We've got like one more minute. Let's rush through it. Question.
One more question here because I just love this question. Athletes you admire when younger and then you found out they're total jerks.
Oh, God. I mean, what can I say?
Welcome to Boston. There's a bunch for this one.
Yeah, you know what? I've always been someone who kind of – I've always, like, been around jocks. I know they're a bunch of jerks, so nothing surprises me. You know what, though? The biggest surprise – and wow, this is our not talking about wrestling segment. The biggest surprise to me was like sometimes good guy wrestlers would be like real jerks, which should not have surprised me, but it did.
I wrote down three, and two of the – I was pretty much big fans of all of them. Larry Bird.
Yeah, Larry's got a real reputation.
Oh, boy, did I make a mistake there because, I really flipped on Larry when he threw Maxwell under the bus for losing in 85. Bird's the one who got into the bar fight over on State Street during the semifinals. Anyway, so Bird, yeah, and Bird, I'm sitting there reading a bio from Bird with Bob Ryan, and he was talking about how he saved some money on the house he bought his mother, how he got a cheaper – I was like, oh, stop. And it was supposed to sound good. It was one of those things where he meant it to sound good, but it just didn't sound good. Then okay. Wade Boggs, once we start getting to know know him by the late 80s. Ended up being, you know, just a lovely guy. And then, yeah, Ken Stabler was another one who, unfortunately, as our friend Bo James once told me, don't start looking too much into your heroes. Just accept them as they are, because you're going to get disappointed.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know what, though? Like, you can't, to me, you can't go through life thinking these guys walk on water. I think, you know, it's, you got to grow up at some point.
Oh, that's fine. You don't have to dig too deep either. I mean, you have to understand all these people are human as well.
Right, exactly. And some of them, you're right, some of them are just assholes. But anyway, I want to thank Sean for hanging out for an extra hour with us. Thank you, Lou Kippelman, for hanging out an extra hour with us. Yeah, we'll be here next week with what might be another different kind of show. Either way, we've got some really cool stuff lined up for year two, and I sincerely thank everyone who listens to this podcast. This will be the last thing I say. I know there are a lot of podcasts out there. It's a ridiculous amount. And when someone chooses this podcast over all of the other podcasts, really, thank you so much for that. I really can't say how much I appreciate it enough. My name is John McAdam. This has been the Stick to Wrestling Podcast. We'll see you guys next week.
Stick to Wrestling with John McAdam and Sean Goodwin is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. I'm your producer, Lou Kippelman. Year 2 starts next time. We'll talk to you then.